1, 2, 3, 4. Excellent. Cool. Right. Hello and welcome back to the Cine Skinny. It's Peter and Jamie in a meeting room. Hi, Jamie.
Hello.
So we are just doing a quick intro before a Studio Ghibli themed episode that you may have noticed from the fact that the episode title is The Cine Skinny Guide to Studio Ghibli. If you haven't cracked the code, this is not a prank. This is what's about to happen. But we have a few things to plug. A couple of good Scottish film festivals coming up and some film screenings that I think we just keep forgetting to mention on the podcast. So we'll do the film screenings first. Cine Skinny Film Club is back with movie Yannick is the next film, which is the new Quentin Dupieux, all about a guy who goes to see a really bad play and then decides that the best course of action is to take everyone hostage and make the play better.
We've all been there.
And with the first time we recorded this, Ellie, who was with us at the time, asked, did we not think that this was a concern when we put on the screening at the film club? And we said no at the time, and I'm sticking to it. So audience, be on your guard. I have vouched for you personally to say that you will not try and sabotage this screening. So they are on the 2nd and 3rd of April, is that right?
That's right.
At Summer Hall and CCA, so go to theskinny.co.uk/tickets for those. And this week coming, two of Scotland's premier film festivals are returning at the same time in slightly different parts of the country. One of them's very quiet and one of them's got lots of short films in it. So James is going to talk us through those both briefly. Do you want to go HipFest first?
Sure.
Cool. So the Hippodrome Festival of Silent Film, or HipFest for short.
Yes.
What is it? Hit me.
Well, it's taking place from the 20th to the 24th of March. Did you say that already? Or am I repeating myself?
No, I referred to it being soon. And then what you've done is you've clarified that using actual facts. So thanks for doing that.
Well, it is returning to Hippodrome. It's a really great festival. As ever, it's got an amazing lineup of silent era films, which are brought right up to date because it's going to have new scores, new performances, and live music. Some highlights, perhaps. I would say the opening film, Peggy, is a riot. It's like a... It's an American film where about a young woman who is of Scottish heritage, who's dragged back to the homeland and causes all sorts of chaos back in Scotland when she gets dumped with her kind of Presbyterian uncle. And she's like this kind of flapper from the 20s who, just causes chaos. Victor Fleming's Mantrap looks great. That's the Friday night film.
Is the film called Mantrap or is it called Victor Fleming's Mantrap? Because either way, that's great. But
well, yeah, it's Mantrap directed by
Victor Fleming. Okay, cool.
I think this is before Victor Fleming was famous, so he probably didn't have the power to have his name in the title as like John Carpenter's Wellhouse films. So yeah, this is a comedy starring Claire Bow. I heard great things. I really look forward to a film called The Racket as well. I'm actually introducing this film at the festival, so I should say it's good. It is very good. It's a kind of proto gangster film before like gangster films were all the rage in the sound era. This is from Lewis Millstone. Really kind of great, like late sort of silent film from 1928. Lots of kind of startling images. Kind of very funny. Kind of full of like two gangster and a cop who hate each other, but they're actually kind of frenemies and like just got lots of banter between the two. So that's one I'm looking forward to.
Nice. And not to go full service journalism for a second, but how do you get to Bowness?
It's kind of tricky, actually. You have to, I mean, the easiest way I think is to get the train to Linlithgow and then get either a bus or a taxi from Linlithgow to the Bowness. But there is buses that go to Bowness as well, but they take a bit longer. Or you could drive if you have a car. This is also a possibility. Some people have cars. Not everybody's like us, Peter, like walking around on our feet like we're, you know, children.
Running around Glasgow to get you lot the scoop with Big Vigo and Sully McLeod, whose name I keep forgetting when I reference the podcast, went on social media and I keep dinging in Sully and being like, we chatted to Vigo, and Sully was there also. Sully was lovely. So
Sully was very cool.
Yeah, I don't want to be bagging on him. Good man. Anyway, so that was HipFest. And the other one that's coming up is Glasgow Short Film Festival. Which
yes.
is also, is that exactly the same dates, isn't it?
Exactly the same dates. Why do you do this to me? Glasgow Short Film Festival and HipFest. I love yous both, but I can't be in two places at once. It's impossible.
He's good, but he's not that good. Jamie, carry
on. Yeah, I mean, the Short Film Festival, another film festival we love. Yeah, it's going to be good this year. It's opening with a bunch of undiscovered or unseen sort of short films by Bill Douglas, shot in 8mm. Bill Douglas, of course, being the kind of great Scottish filmmaker who is actually got a good connection with the film festival. All the kind of international competition is named after him. So it makes sense that they're going to premiere these short films. I mean, actually, it ties in quite well with the Silent Film Festival because these short films are on 8mm. They don't have a soundtrack, and they're going to be soundtracked by Gerard Black, who's a Scottish musician who's done a few things at the film festival before. That should be a really good opening. Also really looking forward to Folkloric, which is something we previewed in this month's magazine. It's like a couple of programmes of shorts digging into kind of films about folklore and kind of folk horror. One of the programmes is kind of quite traditional kind of folk horror ish films, and the second half, the second programme, is a kind of much more subversive take on it. But that's, I've seen some of the films and I can vouch for those, they're great. Also looking forward to Towards Liberation, which is a strand at the really heart of the festival this year. It's about kind of, it's a programme exploring ideas around imprisonment, imperialism, you know, resistance. It's got a lot of kind of connections to what's happening in Gaza. There's a whole programme of Palestinian films. So yeah, that's a real good one to look at for as well.
Excellent. And the GSFF is at the GFTCCA and somewhere else that doesn't have an abbreviation.
And Civic House.
Civic House. CH. Yes. Incorporating PC. It's just on the other side of CC, up the road from the CCA. Yeah. If you hit the WE, you've gone too far.
You've lost me there.
Cool. So that is all the stuff we wanted to plug up top. Speaking of resistance, you're about to hear a conversation that me, Jamie, and Ellie had about Studio Ghibli. Look ahead for some anti-war stuff, a very, very, very cool pig with some interesting political ideas and a great plane, and a whole bunch of fantastical woodland folk just kicking about. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate, I'd say.
That'll do. Anyway, yes, this is me, Jamie, and Ellie talking about Studio Ghibli. We will see you the other side of whatever sound effect I choose to put in here. Goodbye.
Bye.
We are going to go from top to bottom of the Studio Ghibli filmography. For the uninitiated, Studio Ghibli, the Japanese animation studio, founded in the 80s by Toshio Suzuki and a pair of directors, Isao Takahata and the aforementioned Big Ledge, Hayao Miyazaki, best beard in the game, making lovely animated features for the last 40 years, very kind of beloved, intriguing, magical, mystical, etc., etc. We are going to try and speedrun the entire Studio Ghibli output in the space of the next just under an hour. So if you want more info, or perhaps people who can agree on whether it's pronounced Ghibli or Ghibli or Ghibli, I could recommend the Ghibliotech podcast, which is very, very good, extremely in-depth about Studio Ghibli in a way that you can be when your whole podcast is named after the film studio you're talking about. Whereas we are putting together one episode in this small room in Summer Hall. We're having a great time.
And we're talking, I mean, in many ways we're better because we're talking about the whole thing in one episode. So come to us instead. You'd have to listen to 40 episodes of Ghibliotech to get a handle on it.
You would get 40 times as much information, and, but it would take you 40 and times longer.
And well-researched information as well.
Exactly. I mean, like, it is a kind of multiplying thing that, like, the longer you listen to somebody talk about something, the more you'll learn. But what if you just need to know a tiny little bit quickly? Well, that's why we're here. Let's fucking go. Right. So yeah, we're going to go from top to bottom, go through the Ghibbles, see what's what, and pick out some of our like key themes of the work of particularly Takahata and Miyazaki, some of the kind of things that come across in the films, and some of our personal favourites. But in the words of Jamie Dunn in the office this morning, the big question is, are we considering Nausicaa as part of the canon? Now, Jamie, to any uninitiated non-Ghib heads in the room, what does that sentence mean? Illuminate us.
Well, Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind, was made in 1984. It's directed by Miyazaki, and Takahata is the producer. So it's Ghibli through and through, but it was before the studio was founded. So some people don't class this the first Ghibli film, although if you look up Ghibli on Netflix, you'll find Nausicaa there. So do you want to listen to Ghibli heads or Netflix? Who do you trust more on this issue?
Who do I trust more? People on the internet or Netflix.com? It really is, Elia, that's something of a horrible paradigm to find yourself in.
Corporate or fandom?
Well, I would say I'm going to put it in the canon because I think Nausicaa lays the groundwork for everything that comes next.
That is a powerful statement. Carry on, Jamie.
Well, it's got all the themes that come up we're going to probably be talking about. It's got an amazing kick-ass female lead, Nausicaa. It's got environmental themes. It's set like 1,000 years after the Earth has become decimated by this kind of like toxic jungle that's covered the Earth and like big insects roam through it. But then the protagonist works out that actually, instead of fighting these insects and burning down the jungle, it's much better to live in harmony with the jungle and live in harmony with these insects. And actually, if you kill the jungle, we'll all be doomed, because actually it's healing itself. So humankind should stand back and let nature do its thing, which is very much a kind of Ghibli philosophy. It's got a lot of flying in it. There's like a lot of kind of air battles. Nausicaa flies around in a kind of little glider, which is very kick-ass and very cool. And it's got a hot boy in it, which is, like, as we're going to mention, a returning theme of Ghibli. So, and also is a really good voice cast. It's got Patrick Stewart plays one of the characters, very good. Shia LaBeouf, a young Shia LaBeouf, is in here. Lots of good stuff. Uma Thurman plays, this is another theme that turns up, a baddie who's actually a goodie. So Uma Thurman plays the evil emperor of, or evil princess of one of the warring factions. But actually, she turns out not to be that bad, and she repents and realizes actually I'm better than this, and which is a theme that comes up again and again.
Expertly laid table, pristine tablecloth, all the forks in the right place, lovely stuff. That's how you do a prologue. So that was Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, which leads into what I have dubbed in my very quickly subdivided notes in order to add chapter markers to this episode of the Sydney Skinny Podcast. What I would say is kind of like the first really golden period straight out the gate. Studio Ghibli put out some really, really good, interesting films that, as Jamie said, hit on a lot of these issues of environmentalism, flying, women being cool and good at stuff, etc., etc. But Jamie, you're going to tell us about the first proper Studio Ghibli film, Castle in the Sky.
Yes, this is one of my favourite ones. And I think one of the reasons I love it so much is I've been reading recently that it was inspired by Miyazaki's visit to a Welsh coal mine. It's Miyazaki loving the Welsh, loving the proletariat, loving those guys down the pit, and it's all about inspired by, I think it was during the miner strike actually as well. So it's like, I think he was like over in the UK and just like, what's all this about? What's all these protests? And any sort of that was inspired. A main section of the film is sort of it begins in this kind of coal village, which is really cool. But yeah, I mean, it's got a great voice cast. Anna Paquin is the main character, Sheeta. James Vanderbeck Dawson's Creek fame is Pazu, who's again another little cute boy, which is turns up a lot in Ghibli films, kind of little heartthrob. But it's got a great cast. Cloris Leachman is a pirate queen, very funny. It's actually probably one of the funniest Ghibli films, I would say, and actually one of the most action-packed. It's got tons of great adventure, loads of like great kind of fights and gunplay and like battles in the sky, and you know, is like I say, covering a lot of the themes. Literally, there's a castle in the sky. There's going to be a moving castle later. You know, this, like he recycles a lot of ideas, and these are the kind of very early drafts of it. I wouldn't say this is one of his perfect films. It's actually a bit. The plot is a little bit meandering, I think. But in terms of the action, in terms of the characters, I think it's one of his most fun. You know, he's just a master at work when it comes to action and sort of characters in motion and you know, planes and stuff flying through the sky. So yeah, very exciting and a great opening. I think my favorite opening to any Ghibli film is where you think a young girl has died, she's fallen out of a plane, and actually she survived through the magic of a magic necklace.
Now the thing about, yeah, this will be a genuine, like a constantly recurring issue, that when adults are in the room, they are invariably in some kind of flying machine, right? Kind of like Phileas Fogg, Biggles the kind of dandy airman, mm-hmm, kind of situation. But the film that they followed this up with is, I would say, as somebody who hadn't seen a lot of Studio Ghibli stuff until about 10 years ago, I still knew the main character from this film. Mm-hmm. I would say that for most people between the ages of about 12 and 50, they will recognize the main character from this second Studio Ghibli film just on sight. They'll be like, I know that guy with his big head, his giant smile, his weird proportions. It's My Neighbor Totoro, Hayao Miyazaki. Two young girls move to the countryside, get into some scrapes and japes with magical spirits of the woods. There's the environment again. And they hang about with a bus that's also a cat. And everyone's big smiley boy, Totoro. I don't know what he's supposed to be, but he's great.
I have a doorstop shaped like Totoro. I think you can probably get anything shaped like Totoro. Again, it's one of the most iconic designs in animated films.
Because it's a big oblong with ears.
It's a big guy. He's just a big guy.
He's an absolute unit.
Yeah. And he's friendly as well. But like, that's the thing, I think, that My Neighbor Totoro introduces one of the things that like Studio Ghibli became known for, which is that very blissful domesticity. It's not big and sweeping and fantasy at all, really. It's more magical realist, wherein like these two girls have just moved to a new house. The sort of excitement of children like exploring this new area is intertwined with them falling deeper and deeper into this magical world, where really the sort of spiritual, the little sort of spirits and creatures represent sort of childhood innocence. Like, it takes a very long time for any real conflict to appear in the film. Like, I think that, like, you know, the youngest sister like meets Totoro and then keeps trying to bring her family to meet Totoro, but Totoro never shows up. And it's like, that doesn't really turn out to actually be a conflict. It's not some sort of like mischievous thing. If anything, it's just sort of like character building. Totoro is a bit of a mischievous.
Feels like the biggest conflict is like the bus. Buses are very unreliable.
The buses are unreliable.
In rural Japan, which is someone who lives
public
in
public transport.
Someone from Ayrshire. Yeah. I totally identify with standing at a bus stop for over an hour in the rain, yeah, waiting for someone to get off.
Ayrshire could really do with a big smiling cat bus that can fly through the sky.
Yes.
Conflict does eventually, like real conflict does appear in the film, in that, like, you know, conspicuously the mum isn't here. You know, it's the dad and the two girls, and the mum isn't here, and you might begin to wonder why not, and then that factors in around the third act of the film. There might be some real, like, dark, difficult stuff happening in the real world. So these, like, whimsical nature spirits that Miyazaki's put on screen have a very important role to play in, like, the protection and continuation of childhood wonder. Which, yeah, so it's absolutely the sweetest film. I think that a lot of the time, this and the Miyazaki's preceding Kiki's Delivery Service get considered, like, the best Ghibli films for kids, which I actually think isn't necessarily true. I think that, at least when I was little, I loved the way more exciting stuff, like Spirited Away or something like that. But I think that they're the best films about kids. Mm-hmm. He has such a very clear definition of childhood innocence. The sort of fickle boundary between the real world and the magical other world is something that will come up repeatedly in his filmography.
Yeah, I think that this is, like, this one in particular, it really does showcase that thing that, like, a lot of the Ghibli magic comes from nature, like, directly or indirectly. So very kind of like lush, painterly kind of like outdoor landscapes, and a lot of the films are about protecting those, like, landscapes, protecting, like, green spaces, and then partly because magical things literally come from those places. It's not just that the woods are magic, it's that the woods are Cap M magic, and they'll send a big lad out. And then shortly they will send a number of big lads out, and you will be very surprised at what they look like, let me tell you. So yeah, My Neighbor Totoro, excellent.
Also a hunky dad.
Yeah, pretty hunky dad.
Castle in the Sky, also good. Having slam dunked the funk pretty extensively, he lets Takahata have a shot. That's unkind, actually. Asao Takahata directs Grave of the Fireflies. Miyazaki doesn't let him have a shot. They're both in charge. Anyway, so having done Castle in the Sky and Totoro, Miyazaki will be back shortly to replace, in the meantime, in 1988, Grave of the Fireflies, Asao Takahata. Jamie, you want to talk about this a bit, I believe.
Yes, well, I actually just watched it last night because I embarrassingly have not seen any Takahata films.
And Me neither.
I don't know why. I mean, certainly it is the Miyazaki ones that I think people sort of return to again and again. But this was amazing, and it is actually very often held up as, like, among the best. You know, if you look at people's rankings, you know, Grave of the Fireflies is seen by a lot of people as among the best, if not the best, Studio Ghibli film. Yeah, it's absolutely devastating. Weirdly, it was released the exact same time as Totoro. It was because they were made back-to-back in production, and they were released at the same time as a double bill in Japan, which I think is insane, because one is the most uplifting, beautiful, kind-hearted film, and the other one is the most depressing movie. But actually, they have a lot of themes. They're both about siblings who are kind of left to their own devices, and Totoro is a much more magical kids left to their own devices running around a field having a great time in post-war Japan. But crucially, Grave of the Fireflies happens at the very tail end of the war in 45, when Kobe is airbombed, and two kids who are with their mother are caught up in the attack. The mother is badly burned and eventually dies, and it's about two kids basically trying to survive on their own in Kobe in Japan. And it's essentially a metaphor for Japan and the end of the war. You know, the war is essentially over in Germany. Germany have surrendered months earlier, but Japan keep on fighting out of pride. And this happens to these kids. These kids, out of pride, cannot ask for help. There's just a kind of thing in Japan where to beg is sort of beneath you. So these kids essentially go to a shelter. After being sort of mistreated by their aunt, who they go and stay with, they leave and go to a shelter and have to kind of fend for themselves. And it's just watching two kids slowly deteriorate and one of them slowly die from starvation. And it's really heartbreaking, but it's just full of such wonderfully beautiful moments. It's not as magic realist or psychedelic as Miyazaki is. And I don't know if that's the same for the rest of Takahata's work, but it's much more pastoral, much more kind of realist. I would say it's like the kitchen sink Ghibli film, you know. It's like, it's very much not in the magic realm.
I've always seen it mentioned online in people's rankings of like the most tragic films of all time. Like I've heard it's quite a difficult watch.
Yeah, I mean, there's no kind of like sliver of hope in it at all, you know. It starts with the main character saying, "I died tonight," and then you see him slump over in train station dead, and then it flashes back to show how he got to this point where he's starving in a train station. And it's just the whole tragedy of like the film is like very much an anti-war message, you know. It's criticizing Japan directly for continuing this war and letting its, you know, not surrendering earlier and sort of letting its population starve to death. But it's also got a comment about, like, you know, we see at the end of the war a lot of the posher kids coming back, you know, and celebrating and sort of having a good time. But these kids didn't have the opportunity to go and escape the war. They were left in Kobe to die. So it's like really, yeah, it's showing that during the war there was also a kind of a kind of divide between the rich and the poor. The poor were left to fend for themselves, had no food, and, you know, it's really heartbreaking, and it would continue a theme of anti-war that runs through all Ghibli's films as well.
Yeah, the anti-war stuff does come up again and again, as you would expect it would from people producing films in Japan in the 1980s. That was Grave of the Fireflies. Maybe need a fun one now, mm-hmm. which is just as well that Miyazaki's back on the block. There is definitely, so we'll talk more about Takahata in a bit, because there's a couple more of his to come. And I think it's true that, yeah, Miyazaki is the filmmaker who has a slightly more kind of like magical and sort of whimsical is the wrong word, but a kind of lighter, more playful touch. A lot of Takahata's work for Studio Ghibli is much more centered in human relationships and human situations. Let's talk about a young girl who can fly and has a talking cat. Kiki's Delivery Service, Hayao Miyazaki, 1989. They were absolutely ripping through it. Fair play to the lads. Mm-hmm. Between 1984 and 1989, you know, when you look back, right, through the pop charts and you see that all these albums, or you see those posts on Instagram that are like, the following albums came out on exactly the same day. You're like, I didn't know that Nelly Furtado and Pearl Jam had worked things out, so they both come out in the same day. Shocking behavior. So yeah, these five films in the space of 5 years, an incredible run. Kiki's Delivery Service, Ellie, what do you reckon?
I mean,
tell the people all about it.
So yeah, it is about a small girl called Kiki who is a witch who has the power of flight on her broomstick, who has this sort of adventure where she decides to partake in the real human mortal world, and she forms a delivery service, which is very, very cute. Lots of flying around delivering cakes for people. It brings up one of Miyazaki's motifs that's already kind of appeared in Nausicaa and Castle in the Sky, but I think that he shows a little bit more of himself in this when he depicts flight in Kiki's Delivery Service. Like, Kiki loses her powers when she becomes disillusioned by the exploitative labor practices of everyday life, but forms a really, really beautiful relationship with Tombo, who's just a normal boy who loves planes, like loves flying, sort of builds his own plane, which just immediately crashes, and he's a bit of a daredevil. And it's possibly like a Miyazaki self-insert, because the greater psychology of Miyazaki being obsessed with planes from a young age will keep cropping up.
Not to spoil anything or jump ahead, but what was Hayao Miyazaki's dad's job?
I think he built propellers for the planes that were used in World War II.
Truly a slam dunk psychoanalysis, like easy mode psychoanalysis.
He keeps pointing to that more and more, and I think that flight and his feelings about planes in particular just do get reassessed as time goes on. But Yeah, I mean, I think that this is just its most earnest. This is his most earnest, like, interest in flight, in that it is just like this beautiful, fun thing that really brings together these two kids, one who can no longer fly and one who's always wanted to fly. So they're kind of perfect for each other. It also, like, introduces a sort of rarer theme in Miyazaki's work of art. Like, Kiki meets an older witch. I don't even know if she's meant to be a witch or just another person. I think she's meant to be a witch. Ursula, who, like, lives in a cabin filled with paintbrushes. And she explains, like, oh, sometimes your magic will, you know, go away and leave you and it'll feel terrible, but it'll always come back to you so long as you just keep engaging with the world around you and look. And it's a very, like, big sister moment. It's very, like, assuring. It's very sweet and sort of, again, not conflict free, but it's very cushioned. But yeah, I think this is where you begin to have characters who represent a little bit of a voice for that child within Miyazaki and his obsession with the joys of flight.
Yeah, Jimmy, do you have anything to add on Kiki's Delivery Service?
Nothing beyond it's lovely. It's also got, like, a lot of food in it. I think food is also something we haven't mentioned.
Yes.
There's a total Ghibli food fetish going on. Like, I feel like every time I watch a Ghibli film, I'm really hungry afterwards, and I just want to eat, like, that bit of bread or that egg.
There's a, like, this, maybe this is getting into, like, too much of, like, a sort of design nerdery, but the way they depict water and liquid and soup and stuff like that, rather than looking like very fluid, it all looks like one big blob. Like, the raindrops look really fat and heavy, and soup always looks quite homogeneous. And it's because it's like, you know, he's making it look not how it looks in real life, but how it feels, how liquid feels to move across the screen. And I think that always plays into how well food and drink look in his films.
Yeah, absolutely. And there'll be more food and drink later. But at the, to kind of round off this bit before things get pretty odd quite quickly, Only Yesterday, which came out in 1991, which is another Isao Takahata, this is more of like a belated, what I think is like a belated coming of age tale. So it's about a young woman who lives in Tokyo, has a kind of office job, and goes on holiday to the country with some kind of family friends. And it sort of flashes back to her childhood, and she kind of like relives a lot of memories that she has from her childhood days. Again, more grounded, a bit less magical, less kind of cartoony. I think one of the things that particularly with, well, people like myself, your lay cinema watcher, does kind of conflate Hayao Miyazaki films with Studio Ghibli films. And going through them all at, like this, does actually remind you that Miyazaki makes a certain kind of film, but Studio Ghibli make a certain kind of film. This is, yeah, less kind of like magical and much more kind of person-centered. That does make it a bit dull compared to some of the other ones, but then maybe I'm just a dimwit who doesn't know anything about films. The other thing about this film is that it didn't have an English voice dub for a very, very long time. I think it's important to say that these films were always massive in Japan, but there has been renewed kind of Western, like, Anglosphere interest in, certainly since, like, the 2000s. So a lot of them have English voice dubs with kind of like modern casts. So this one has Daisy Ridley and Dev Patel as the English leads. Again, big names. We're talking star power. There's going to be more of that later. But yeah, Only Yesterday is like an interesting and quite like humanistic piece. But I personally don't like it as much as the ones with the giant like rabbits and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that's just my prerogative as an idiot. Probably a good place to put a little.
Yeah.
In part one, we talked a lot about the kind of origins of Ghibli. And now that they're established as one of the premier animation studios in the world, it's time for things to get well weird. And we're going to get well weird in the first instance with 1992's Porco Rosso by Hayao Miyazaki, starring the anti-fash legend, flying fighter pilot pig who loves to smoke and get steaming and is weirdly a sexist and has a great haircut, Porco Rosso. So it's set in France and Italy around the time of the Second World War. It's another film about flying. It's another film about the war. It's another film about what do you do in situations of wartime? And what do you do when you are kind of struggling with things that are going on in your life and you're flashing back and having memories, but also you are a large pig. It's really, really, really good. And before we get into an actual conversation about what the film is about, I just really want to talk about the fact that we've all met this guy, right? We've all met a guy who's like anti-fash legend, but is a bit of a sexist and just loves to smoke like a chimney and get pissed as a fart every single Friday night. That's Paul.
Have we? I can't think of any.
Yes, you have.
And he was also cursed to be, look like a pig.
Exactly. And he flies away. Please never catch him. Right. So, Jamie, Porco Rosso. This starts a period of Studio Ghibli that I have dubbed "Whoa, pal, that's a bit out there." Fair play. What did you think? Do you think of Porco Rosso?
This is one of my favourites. I think it's quite underrated, I would say. It's actually really cool to see Miyazaki working in Europe. You know, I think it's his only film. I could be wrong there.
Kiki's Delivery Service is, the architecture is very like Sweden inspired, but I don't think it's meant to be specifically historical. And I think Howl's Moving Castle
that is in Europe,
like,
yes.
Central Europe.
Yeah, yes. So, but anyway, I think it's kind of cool to see his, because we see Ghibli tackle war in Japan quite a few times. It's interesting to see them take it outside of Japan. But yeah, to me, this is basically his Indiana Jones film. Like, Porco Rosso is just a swashbuckling punk, basically. He's up for fighting. There's lots of gunfights, fist fights. Great kind of aerial battles. I think this is one of the great flying films. You know, he has this kind of like fun romance at the start of it. What I kind of like is they never explain why he's a pig. It's like one of these mysteries that's just never explained. I think, like, you know, this is something that maybe makes Ghibli stand apart. I feel they don't need to explain their mystery or their. I think like an American film would say, what is there, a magical ring or a magical witch that's cursed you? It's just like he's a pig. You know, I don't think it's ever explained. And I kind of like that. I think it's like an interesting sort of take. But yeah, really, really fun, really cool, action packed. I think a really underrated one, I would say.
I also would like to say, I know that this is a film predominantly for children, but Porco Rosso, canonically, Mad Shagger, mm-hmm. right? Let's be honest. He goes to the Cafe Adriatico. So there's an island bar that's frequented by all of the sky pirates, where they go and listen to easy listening music performed by the landlord of the bar. You know, classic kids film shit. And he, Porco, disappears upstairs to go and have his dinner. Full bottle of wine, ledge. And it's heavily implied, if not outright said, that he was like, he was in some kind of relationship with this woman. Mm-hmm. But also that he is like seemingly irresistible to any number of other women. Yeah. But also he just, for no real reason, denigrates a bunch of women who have been brought, because it's wartime, obviously, is what the implication is, that all of the men are off doing something else. So when he needs a crack squad of people to rebuild his fighter plane, he's like, you can't get women to build my plane. It's like, Porco, I'm confused. I thought that you were a good guy, and yet here you are talking a whole heap of bish.
I mean,
unstoppable, ungovernable behavior.
But he's a pig, so you know.
Yeah, I think this film stands out for a lot of reasons against what had already come out from Studio Ghibli so far. I think that you're right, it's like, it's not just set in Europe, it's like set in a historical, political Europe. Like, it uses the actual context of the place that it's set in. And that does also kind of inform a more distinct visual style. Like, the entire thing looks like vintage tourism posters. It's just like, you know, everyone's in white suits and, you know, lighting their cigarettes from their matchbooks, and like the sky's so like blue and beautiful. But yeah, this character, this central character, is a little more roguish than anyone we've really had in a Studio Ghibli film so far. He is also a pig, and yet that sort of goes unexplained. Like, there's no big transformation scene, there's no like stepping into this other world. It actually is very understated, as is the encroaching threat of fascism. Like, a big impetus for the story is the fact that this is the interwar period, but I think that like fascism is rising in Italy and there's a warrant out for Porco's arrest. But we never meet a fascist character. There's the American character who's, again, quite roguish, meant to be maybe like Errol Flynn or Ronald Reagan or something like that, who's a Hollywood star who wants to be president. But we never meet a character who kind of like outlines the definition of fascism and what these bad guys want and what they stand for in the story. But again, that is sort of like a technique that's been used already in Totoro. Like I said, there's this conspicuous like absent mother. Only nearer to the end of the film does it begin to like address that, when the first half is just enjoyable fun with giant cat bus slash swashbuckling pigman.
It does that thing, kind of like Ledge filmmaking, where it just says that, like, this guy's cool, so you know that the people who he's against are not cool. Mm-hmm. It's like, it uses Porco Rosso as, like, he's the guy who we all like. So when he says he doesn't want to be like the other lot, you know that they're bad.
Yeah. I mean, is it like Humphrey Bogart in, like, Casablanca, mm-hmm. or Jean Gabin in, like, you know, The Grand Illusion? It's like these anti-hero characters. They're roguish, but they're really good guys. You know, yeah. the guys who are, like, up to no good, but, you know, they're usually smuggling stuff, or they've got, like, a backhanded deal, but they're actually, you know, they're on the side of good, and that's, like, Porco Rosso.
Which, like, it gets into Miyazaki's more complex feelings about planes, once again, because there's about 1,000 planes in this film. They're beautiful. They're all, like, different colors and different shapes and sizes, and they all sort of have their own personalities. And again, that first half of the film where there's sky pirates kidnapping little kids and Porco Rosso, like, flies in and saves the day. It looks so thrilling. It looks so exciting. And yet he's a very closed off character. He's, like, very sort of, you know, dejected and sort of lives on this island out in the middle of nowhere where he'd rather just, like, sunbathe and smoke all day long. Again, there's this big question of, like, what has transformed this guy? He has previous experience flying during World War I, and it never sort of overtly points the finger at that, but to me it was always like, this is a guy who wants to distance himself from the celebration and admiration that he gets for being a, you know, ace pilot, when in fact he's quite traumatized by it and has turned into a pig presumably because of it somehow.
And I should say, Michael Keaton does the voice dub in English, and it's one of his best performances, mm-hmm. I think. It's, like, so subtle, like, he's so emotional. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not actually, you know, Michael Keaton, you think, is the crazy guy from, like, Beetlejuice or Batman, but, like, yeah, he does some really subtle work here, and yeah, he's really good.
So that was Porco Rosso. That has a whole bunch of stuff going on in it. But you know what? We're back to Isao Takahata, and he's going to bring us back down to Earth with something that's more kind of, like, humanistic. More relatable. Oh no, he's done a film about magical shape-shifting raccoon dogs fighting the destruction of their environment by virtue of their enormous pendulous scrotums. So, Pompoko, 1994, it follows this group of tanuki, who are this kind of like Japanese magical mythical kind of group of sort of like, they're not raccoons, they're not dogs, they're kind of like some form of animal in that area. Imagine the American kids animation. It might have just been called The Raccoons, about the group of raccoon superheroes. Imagine that, but with slightly bigger teeth. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here. Urbanization is coming to their part of Japan, and they want to protect the environment that they have lived in for a very long time. They do this by various means of eco-terrorism, scrapping with folk, and bouncing around on enormous balls. Like, I cannot stress enough the balls on these lads in every sense of the phrase. It's a weird one. It feels like it's weirdly kind of a piece with Porco Rosso, because it is actually about quite a serious subject, and it's handled weirdly not in an overblown way, but they keep bouncing around on the balls.
I mean, you wanted less of Takahata's incredibly mundane human stuff.
Yeah, but now I don't know that is what I wanted, Ellie. I'm so conflicted.
You asked for tanuki balls.
I am having a whale of a time with Studio Ghibli, but I don't know what I want. So that was, it's maybe time to bring some new voices into the mix, such as in the next bit of the notes. So after Pompoko, Whisper of the Heart comes the next year, and this is the first filmmaker who isn't one of the original duo of Takahata or Miyazaki, because it's Miyazaki with Yoshifumi Kondo. Jamie, you're down here to talk about Whisper of the Heart, a film I haven't seen, so I'm really relying on you to know something about it. Hit
yeah,
me.
I think this is one of the kind of like lost gems in the canon, I would say. Yeah, unfortunately, Kondo, he was kind of all set. He was a protege of Miyazaki. He was all set to kind of like be one of the kind of important voices in the studio, but he just died very soon after this release, so it's like one of the great kind of one and done films, I think. But yeah, it's like much more of a teen drama though. This is about, it's about first crushes, it's about kind of finding out what you want to do with your life. It's about a young girl who's living in West Tokyo, and she realizes she's a book lover, and she realizes that all her favorite books have been checked out by the same guy. And it turns out this guy is like a real cutie, but he's also really annoying, and she gets really frustrated. She doesn't know why she's always annoyed when she's around him. So it's very much a very kind of cute, kind of cozy film about first love. But it's also got this kind of great fantasy section, because she also gets enamored with this statue of a cat, called The Baron she finds in a kind of old antique shop, and then she starts writing a book about it, and then kind of slip into these fantasies where she's kind of like writing. So it's a film that manages to be like quite realist teen drama. It has all the flights of fantasy that we, you know, have known from the Ghibli films. But yeah, there's something really cozy and warm and sort of sweet about it. Like I just love it so much. Like a lot of just the domestic scenes are fantastic. Like there's a lot of scenes just her at home in her tiny apartment with her mum and dad, who are kind of academics, and her big sister, who's like very prim and proper and trying to tell her to do well at school, but all this girl wants to do is like read books and sort of chase after this boy. Absolutely lovely. I would say if you've passed over it because it's not by one of the kind of great names of Ghibli, I would say check it out because it's, I think, among the best.
Excellent. And we talked about, you mentioned there, Flights of Fantasy. I believe, Ellie, in our next bit, we're going full-blown supersonic Concorde fantasy. Princess Mononoke, one of the biggies.
Yeah.
1997, Hayao's back on the boards, on the ones and twos, spinning the platters that matter. Help. Tell me about Princess Mononoke.
To me, this was like Miyazaki bringing out the big guns, the big pacifism guns. It's incredibly fucked up.
The big guns that stop everyone using their actual guns.
The big anti-guns. Like, you know, I don't think that, like, to me, it really stands out. Again, I don't think that it ever gets this fucked up ever again. Like, there's curses and demons, there's body horror, but nothing quite so fucked up as just the complete tragedy that's a sort of at the heart of this film. You know, it's very fantastical. It's set in medieval Japan and follows the last prince of a tribe who is wounded by this demon and has to go on this great journey, an exile of his tribe, to essentially find a solution to this impending doom that he's suffering. And we get really embroiled in this conflict that we find across the land. There's a sort of war depicted between this town, this like industrial human settlement that's wrestling with the magical forces of nature in the surrounding forest. But on top of that, the town itself is populated by like lepers and prostitutes who themselves are outcasts from like a greater, more normative and oppressive culture. So, you know, the crux of the film is the outbreak of this conflict, which involves like deception and these characters' fatal flaws rising to the surface. And the tragedy is sort of predetermined from the start, kind of like a Shakespeare play. And it's just, I suppose, it's like a brutal contrast to something like My Neighbor Totoro or Kiki's Delivery Service, where the magical world is, you know, so much more bigger and involved than it ever has been. And it's not sort of doorway through which we can escape into childhood innocence, but rather it's been embroiled in this war as well. Again, it's sort of Miyazaki coming out at his strongest anti-war stance, I think, because no other film really, like in Porco Rosso, like I said, the fascists are invisible. We never see them. They're just coming and we don't really like get to spend time with them. But in this is a really like devastating, kind of horrific looking war between factions that strangely are all kind of, they all have their own sense of justice. They all have some level of justification for what they're doing, which just makes it so much more tragic in a weird way and so much more like difficult to process. And yet it's an absolutely gorgeous film. Like it's upheld. I've heard lots of people uphold it as the best Ghibli film, which again, I think because of its scale and complexity of its themes, totally deserves that.
Yeah, this is probably the first one I saw when I was a kid, like the first, and it did blow my mind. It's like the imagery in it is incredible. Like I say, it's got this kind of grotesque, it opens with this kind of grotesque pig attack, and that was like totally burnt into my mind. It's also like really ambiguous, you know, like what I love about Ghibli films is there's no kind of like real baddies, you know, like the woman who runs this town, which is making the steel to make the guns that killed the demons, you know, is not necessarily a bad character. Like you say, she has taken in all these women and given them places of power. It's a real matriarchy where the women have all the power, the men are kind of useless, and she's given, she treats the lepers really well, you know, so she's an interesting character, even though she's aligned with these people who want to murder the kind of great spirit of the forest. And but yeah, so it's very interesting, very, very, very deep. People compare like Ghibli to Disney all the time. Disney has not even done anything remotely as interesting or as philosophical as this. Really, really rich film that really rewards rewatching. You know, just is one of probably, I would say, the most visually rich film. I would say it is epic. It's quite a meandering film. It's not as tightly like plotted as something like Totoro, for example. But yeah, a great, great movie.
So after Mononoke, something very, very different comes next, which is My Neighbors the Yamadas, Takahata's Back on the Block in 1999. A film that is based on a kind of like hand-drawn manga, and this has a very, very different animation style. You talk about Mononoke being very rich. My Neighbors the Yamadas is very kind of like light and very kind of like individual brushstrokey. Lots of little kind of scenes and vignettes following the family of the title. Clearly by this point, Takahata has a very different vibe to Miyazaki. I have seen people write that he is kind of the one who, after they do, a lot of his projects kind of like bring things back to the center of like, let's talk about people. Let's make something a bit odd. Let's get away from the giant dragons and monsters and things, and let's talk about this family, which you can look at one way or the other. I would rather have the big dragons, but I feel like I'm just ragging on Isao Takahata constantly on this episode of the podcast. So, Mr. Takahata, if you're listening, is he still? Should we check if he's still alive?
No, he's definitely passed away.
Okay, well, in that case, it's probably best to just move on to the next bit. The new millennium, excuse me, Willennium. Studio Ghibli still going into the 2000s, and I think beyond Totoro, the film that most, certainly Western audiences, are most familiar with is 2001's Spirited Away, which won Hayao Miyazaki his first Oscar. Let's find out when this comes out if that has been added to in the intervening time. An absolutely beautiful, excellent, epic, like sprawling but on a kind of small scale, very, very good looking film with good food and weird magical monsters and a small girl off to discover things about the world. Jamie Dunn, what do you have to say about Spirited Away?
Yeah, more pig transformation as well. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's like because a mum and dad start to eat too much street food and sort of gorge and become pigs. Yeah, this is, again, one of the ones I saw really early. I haven't actually rewatched it since, but it's one that's really stuck with me. It's, yeah, utterly magical. I think it's where he takes his kind of dream logic to kind of new extremes. You know, it's a very dreamy, nightmarish film with a girl going through this world. It's also a bit work as well. Like, he also makes a lot of films. She gets, like, employed as a kind of, like, a washerwoman for this kind of, like, a band of witches. Yeah, really fun. Again, like, a great female central protagonist. Haven't seen it in a while. I agree with people when they say it's among the best. It's one I want to rewatch. But, yeah, I can see why this is among the most loved.
It does also have that thing, Ellie, that it takes you... You go to the initial point where the action kicks off, and then the parents have become pigs, and then ghostly apparitions appear, and things just start happening in a way that, like Jamie said earlier, those, but even though these films are predominantly, to one extent or another, aimed at children, they don't feel the need to absolutely hammer you over the head with what the point of the film is, or even what the plot of the film is. A lot of, like, they do take you on this, they take you on a journey. You are spirited away.
Yeah. I think that, again, I don't really remember this one that well. I remember loving it, but I've not seen it since I was a kid. But it's, you know, it's got something in common with My Neighbor Totoro in that the impetus of the plot is that the family have moved. So again, it's using that sort of very specific childhood feeling of moving to a new home and being in a completely unfamiliar location, but one that is presumably going to be one that you're going to be living in for years. And just that sense of like trepidation at the threshold of something new that you then like kind of transform into this otherworldly experience. But it does sort of take a different turn than My Neighbor Totoro in that it gets quite visceral. It gets quite, there's something like very menacing about the spirits that we encounter. Whereas Totoro is the remedy for, you know, the problems of real life. Here in Spirited Away, you know, No Face, I think, is the name of the sort of ghoulish antagonist. And then you've got the parents who've been transformed into pigs, like, it's reflections of real life behaviors, darker reflections, but still really exciting, still with a great protagonist who sort of faces it all quite bravely. Like, childhood bravery is sort of what's coming out here that keeps coming out. Another just visually fantastic film. I think what I remember about it is that in the beginning of the film, they're driving in a car to their new home. And it's like quite a nice looking 2001 car. It's like a, I don't know what it's meant to be, like a BMW or something like that. But I'm like, I don't know if there's any other modern cars in Miyazaki films. I can't remember if they're ever just like in,
well,
like...
Well, he's not often set, they're often set in the past.
Yeah, you know, this one's like very modern day, and it's like very strange to see him sort of with his very quite like, you know, almost rustic, very beautiful painterly style depict very ordinary 21st century things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of echoes in one we're going to talk about, The Boy and the Heron, I feel as well. This one sort of, I think, is like very close to that. And it's the whole idea of like going through a looking glass. You know, it's very Alice in Wonderland, falling deeper and deeper into a fantasy. But, you know, it's like a girl working through trauma of going to a new place. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, I don't know if I would say it was deep on that, but I think in terms of the look and the kind of imagination, it's definitely one of the richest.
And I know that we have been talking a lot about the thematic stuff, but I mean, these are animated films and the design of the characters is always incredible, but No Face in particular is hashtag iconic. He is the moment. Just where, in the scenes where No Face is eating and looks like it will consume the entire frame, when it sort of peels back its whole head and starts just like chomping on everything in sight. These films have some of the most like visually iconic, in the most literal sense, bits of character design of any animated film. You can show some of these images to people, and even if they don't know who it is, they know that it's somebody. Mm-hmm. They know that Totoro is somebody, in the same way that they know that like Pikachu is somebody, yeah, or Super Mario is somebody,
yeah,
or Waluigi is somebody. Yeah. Waluigi is somebody very special, but we don't have time to talk about him. 2002, The Cat Returns, which is a spin-off of Whisper of the Heart.
I haven't seen it, but I assume it's just the story that young girl was writing.
I mean, after you mentioned the cat from earlier, I was like, that'll be the cat then.
Yeah, I don't the Baron.
Dare I say it might not be
this
that.
Is the first one that nobody's seen.
I don't want to denigrate the work of Hideyoki Morita or Reiko Yoshida, but we don't really have time. Mm-hmm. Shall we move on to Howl's Moving Castle, an undisputed banger with an incredible English dub voice cast? Lauren Bacall, Gene Simmons, not the one from Kiss, Christian Bale and Billy motherfucking Crystal. Once again, big names are back, baby. Hayao Miyazaki got out the paint and the address book, being like, who wants to be in my film this time? And also, he's not Welsh, but Billy Crystal's character is kind of... Here's what this is, right? So there's a Studio Ghibli video game. We probably don't even have time for this, but you know what? I'm just going to say it anyway. The Studio Ghibli video game for the PS3 and PS4 called Ni no Kuni, Wrath of the White Witch, and you play as a little boy knight around all these kind of Studio Ghibli-drawn environments. And it's your classic, like, JRPG, like Final Fantasy-type situation. But his little pal is this miner's lamp who speaks in a really weird but definitely Welsh accent. And I always get him and Billy Crystal's character mixed up from Howl's Moving Castle. But then in my mind, I was like, but Billy Crystal isn't Welsh. So why am I mixing these two things up?
But then Christian Bale is.
But then Christian Bale is, but he doesn't sound Welsh. Jamie, Howl's Moving Castle, is it good? What's it about? We all love it, don't we?
I like it a lot. Again, it's another one that I haven't seen in a long time. It's one I saw, like, I think my introduction was Spirited Away, Mononoke, and this one. And I think these are seen as kind of three of the best. I always think Mononoke is the one I go back to. I've seen that five times. So there's something about this one that, again, doesn't enchant me as much. But it is like beautiful. It's like very imaginative. It's, you know, it seems a bit more classic in its tale, like, more like a fairy tale. It's like it's kind of got like Disney-esque elements. You know, it's like about being kind of captured by witches. It's like being enslaved. But yeah, really beautiful film. I don't have much more to say about it.
Ellie, what do you have to say about it?
I mean, yeah, so it's instead of nature spirits this time, it's wizards, and they do be wizarding, meddling with human conflict. Like, this is an unexpected one. I think people often forget that it's one of Miyazaki's pieces about war, because there's, again, a war sort of brewing in the background that doesn't really feel as pertinent as the actual main plot itself. The main plot follows Sophie, who's a maker of hats? I think it's hattier.
You carry on. I will look up the correct name for someone.
Cool.
It's a milliner.
A milliner.
A milliner.
Okay. Sophie makes hats. And then this witch quite randomly transforms her into an old woman. So she goes off to try and find Howl, who will reverse the spell or, you know, help out in some way. So Howl is this great flamboyant character who just likes to fly around and sort of cause mischief, but seems quite resistant to the fact that this I don't think they're meant to be, like, I think that's important. I don't think they're meant to be any specific factions that are going to war here. I think that it's just meant to be two kingdoms who are kind of ridiculously similar to one another. I think that it's meant to be quite like an arbitrary fight. I think one of them has a missing prince, and then we discover that It's wizards who are fucking about that are like fueling this war. But the fact that the kingdoms aren't really distinguished at all and that they're just mirrors of each other brings back that sort of Porco Rosso, you know, war brewing in the background and having quite nondescript justifications. It's not like Princess Mononoke where you feel that these factions like have any justifiable cause to go to war with each other. It's just something that you're always hoping is successfully avoided. But yeah, I do like the fact that this slight spoiler, I guess, but like, you know, one of the evil witches, maybe the really evil witch, just sort of chills out halfway through and just becomes like their pal and hangs out with them. And it's a nice little like bonding of like a broken relationship there that is kind of a really sort of sweet contrast to the fact that you've got this central European conflict that's been brewing. But yeah, also Howl transforms into a bird. Miyazaki cannot get enough of flying.
Miyazaki loves to be in the air with his boys. It should also be noted, I kind of glossed over it, Hayao Miyazaki loves flying, but he also loves retiring from making films. Mm-hmm. I think it was after Mononoke, he's like, I'm done. And then he did Spirited Away and was like, I'm not making any more feature films. And then 3 years later, he was back making this film.
Mm-hmm. And that's not even the last time he'll retire.
You know what? Spoiler for later, he will retire again. Right, so that was Howl's Moving Castle by Hayao Miyazaki. But then in 2006, his son Gorō Miyazaki has a crack at the champ, making Tales from Earthsea. I've not seen Tales from Earthsea, so I'm relying on Ellie Robertson to my immediate left to tell me a little bit about it so we can move on to the next bit.
It's an adaptation of the Ursula Le Guin novels, but I got to admit, I started this one and sort of fell off it. So I can't speak with it too authoritatively, but I know that it's not necessarily been well received. It's sort of said to lack that Ghibli magic that the studio is known for. Not to mention the fact that Ursula Le Guin didn't like it as an adaptation. And quite crucially, Hayao Miyazaki publicly slated it and has a, despite, you know, his absolutely enchanting depictions of childhood innocence, has public beef with his own son over this film.
Hayao Miyazaki is, I think Hayao Miyazaki is Porco Rosso. Like, he is a in kind of like incorrigible grump. I think does Hayao Miyazaki, is he often depicted smoking as well? Depicted, photographed as such.
He's often depicted smoking and also complaining about being a filmmaker and how hard it is. He hates being a filmmaker, but he has to do it because I guess it's like, in him, you know.
But the only thing he hates more than being a filmmaker is having to put up with other people's substandard contributions to his films. This is a man who is, this is a kind of an older filmmaker who has memes made of him just, I would say, handing out dogs abuse to his staff. Truly a man after my own heart. Jamie, please tell me about Ponyo. Hayao Miyazaki is once again back on the block. He left the shop in charge, his son in charge of the shop, and the shop burned down. So now he's back.
Yeah,
it didn't burn down. They just didn't sell as much as before. And he's like, I can't believe you've done. You know what? I'll just do it myself. And he did.
Ponyo's, I think, seen as a kind of minor Miyazaki, but I actually think it's wonderful. It's really good. It's like an adaptation of The Little Mermaid, but really an imaginative version of it. Like, so in this version, The Little Mermaid is a tiny little fish that a boy finds. He's out fishing at the sea, and he takes this home, and it grows into a little girl who's like an absolute nightmare. She has chicken legs for some reason. It's very strange. But yeah, like, it's just two kids getting up to all mischief when they're kind of tsunamis. Is that a tsunami? It's some sort of storm is about to hit the town, and they have to go and sort of... but the storm is actually, it's Poseidon coming back for his daughter. So it's like, it's all linked to like the fact that his daughter's kind of like went to the land. Yeah, just really imaginative, they're really fun. It's kind of, it's more of a kid's film, I would say. It's more very kid friendly. It has one of the worst songs over the closing credits. I can't remember who it is. Is it Miley Cyrus's son? Not son, brother. It's honestly atrocious. It's like offensive to the ears. So please leave or switch this off like 5 minutes before the end, because it's not worth listening to at all. But yeah, it's got a great mum character who takes care of the kids, like the ideal mum. You know, she like makes you really nice ramen with ham and eggs for dinner. You know, it's that kind of movie. It's very cozy, very lovely, very seaside kind of version of Miyazaki. I love it.
Is Miley Cyrus, is Noah Cyrus Miley's brother?
No.
There we go.
Noah Cyrus was a... she voiced the titular character in Ponyo. She is the sister.
Okay. All right, but there's not a boy. It's like the youngest child. There's certainly a boy who's singing who's terrible. So I don't want to blame this little girl, but there's somebody who's terrible.
I don't want to blame this Frankie Jonas.
Who I don't know.
It's a Jonas brother.
Is he a Jonas brother?
It's a mini Jonas brother.
I don't want to blame this little girl. I want to blame this small boy instead.
It's the Jonas brother who didn't get into the Jonas Brothers.
Yes. It's the reject Jonas brother who's awful.
There's a lot of family drama unfolding across this filmography. I really apologize to Noah Cyrus.
I do not blame you for the badness of this track. It's this little boy who's awful.
Yeah, I would like to put on the record that I have no strong feelings about Noah Cyrus or the, quote, Jonas brother who couldn't get into the Jonas brother. Then the next bit of the Studio Ghibli story. So we had a kind of golden age right at the start. Then things got a bit weird. Then there was a second golden age. Hayao Miyazaki retired or threatened to retire on multiple occasions. We're now into the 2010s to a clutch of films that I would say, charitably, probably haven't had the same time to become revered by people of our age as the others. You could also say that maybe the concepts aren't as good and some of the filmmaking is not quite there. But that's just me saying that. So, 2010, Arrietty by Hiromasu Yonebayashi. Jamie, have you got something brief to say about Arrietty?
Yeah, I like this. It's very straightforward. It's an adaptation of The Borrowers, and it just adapts The Borrowers. It's not got the magic of Miyazaki. You know, it's not really sort of trying to see anything beyond this little story. But I think it does a very nice job of it. I think the animation is beautiful, and it's a very fun little movie. But beyond that, it's not one I would desperately want to revisit.
Nice. Gorō Miyazaki is out of Time Out by 2011 to produce From Up on Poppy Hill. Has anyone seen this?
No.
I haven't, but I've heard this is actually quite good.
I hear it's better. He's still doing stuff. I think he released some short films for Studio Ghibli, so it's like, I think he's, you know, he's not been banished or anything.
Gorō Miyazaki got shouted at by his dad so hard that we all forgot to watch his film. Rough. But then his dad is back on the scene once again. He's spinning those plates and hoping none of them drop in, I would say, the most late stage Hayao Miyazaki film that there could possibly be, The Wind Rises. It's literally a personal film about flying in a war. It's very down to earth. It's much more like a Takahata film by Miyazaki, I think. And also lots of cool stuff about aviation engineering. Jamie, you were an engineer once.
I was. I love this one. I think this is really, really great. And again, one that's maybe slept on a little bit. It's unusual because it's about a real person. It's about the actual aeronautical engineer. I think he's called Yiro Orikoshi, who he wanted to be a pilot, but his eyesight was bad. So instead, he became an engineer and designed the planes instead. And it's kind of like, I would say it's Miyazaki's Oppenheimer, because essentially he's a character who just loves flying, he loves engineering, he loves making flight better. But of course what happens is his designs and his planes are used to attack Pearl Harbor and sort of exacerbates the war. So it's a real kind of tragic story of this man who loves flying. And I guess it's something that recurs throughout all of Miyazaki's films. It's this tension of like the joy of flying, but how it's used for such destructive ends. So yeah, it's a really tragic film, but it's also a great romance. It's like there's a lot of kind of romantic films but they're kind of quite juvenile romances, usually adolescent romances. This is an adult romance, which is a bit different for Miyazaki as well. Yeah, I think a really great film, much more realist. You know, it's one you can imagine. Actually, this actually doesn't need to be animation. You can imagine like a live action version of this. You wouldn't lose that much.
Mm-hmm. I think it's Miyazaki's most realist work, and I think that like it's a bit slept on. But I don't know if that's just that it hasn't really stuck with the Ghibli fandom because it lacks those sort of magical realist elements. You know, there's no magical world or forest spirits, but there's a bucket load of pathetic fallacy and a couple dream sequences, but also possibly a reason that I think that it never quite materialized as a Ghibli great is because Miyazaki never really intended to make it as a film. He'd made this manga as a personal passion project, and when the studio tried to get him to make a film of it, he kind of rebuffed it. He sort of said that it wasn't for his audience, and I do think that kind of shows. He's obviously reckoning with his conflicted feelings over his love of planes, but his hate of war. And he's sort of found this historical figure who he's sort of a kindred spirit with, you know, who sort of lands in the same camp. And yeah, this sort of conflict over wanting to build beautiful planes, but, you know, knowing that they're going to be used for devastating conflicts. It did catch a lot of flack from different groups. I know that Japan's right wing sort of culture didn't appreciate it, but at the same time, in Korea, like, nobody liked it in Korea, because as it turns out, this was the country that those planes were used to bomb, so they don't really care about the personal journey. But I do agree that at the very center of it, I think that the highlight is this romance, this which seems, again, quite simple, but still somehow so complex, in that, you know, he's fallen in love with this woman, she's ill, and it's that thing where you just absolutely know where it's going to go. You've seen a million films like this, but there's something about the way that he depicts their, like, intimacy and the fact that, you know, she's not well, they can't go out and do great things. There's not much going on in their relationship, but they still clearly love each other very, very much, which is just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I remember it does kind of downplay Japan's part in the war. Like, it certainly implies that, you know, there is a few Nazi characters in it, and it implies that the Germans did drag Japan along for the ride, which is probably not that accurate. But I mean, to me, it's more of a story out of person. You know, I think to me that's why I don't really have an issue. But I can see if you're Korean, you might have an issue.
But again, it's that thing where the warmongering, the fascism is sort of playing at the edges. It's never really, like, addressed or characterized or discussed itself, but it is just this unfortunate force that our characters are kind of helpless against and sort of just wind up playing along with.
So that was The Wind Rises. In the meantime, the Takahata is back on the block. He took 8 years to make The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which is a kind of, but again, a very different project to a lot of the Miyazaki Ghiblis. It's like almost like a watercolor style. It took 8 years to make, and it is the most expensive Japanese film of any kind that's ever been made. 2014, Yone Yabashi's back to make When Marnie Was There. And this time, Hayao Miyazaki claims he's retired again. He tries it on once again, but we all know how this story ends, which is cut to pretty much now, or about 4 months ago. Who's that coming over the hill with an enormous pile of books about the First and Second World Wars and some magical characters, and presumably his son trailing slightly behind him, having been berated once again for not being as good at making films as his old man? Yes, it's the Hayao Miyazaki victory run final use this one.pdf. It's The Boy and the Heron, by all accounts one of the best films of 2023, a film which I shamefully have not watched yet, so I will have to, much like the end of Muppet Christmas Carol, duck out of this conversation and let the two of you have at it. But yeah, I believe that The Boy and the Heron pulls together a lot of the elements that we've talked about so far. So, Ellie, in what way does it pull together all of those elements we've talked about so far?
Really, really well. It has just all of them. Planes, war, magic, grandma. Instead of Jiro Horikoshi from The Wind Rises, who is, like, so focused on his passion for building planes that he's kind of oblivious to all this warmongering and fascism that's happening outside of his story, Mihito from The Boy and the Heron actually is a little fascist. He's like this, you know, little kid during the war who is like a very, like, militant, sort of like aggressive, conflicted child. He gives himself injuries just so that he can, like, create conflict with the other boys. And like many Ghibli characters, he goes down this rabbit hole once he's moved to a new house, and he finds at the other end a magical world where these anthropomorphized birds and in armies war pointlessly at the behest of an eccentric wizard. So yeah, just pulling in, like, all the different motifs, and I think that it is somewhat better at showing his sort of colors in the character Mihito, his father owns this air munitions factory, so he's virtually taking the same place as in Mihito's life as Miyazaki's own father took in his life. And yeah, it allows him to kind of, like, take the magical world and create a lesson out of it, of to end this sort of, like, cyclical violence, to rebuild this reality in a totally different and more thoughtful way. But yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it's got that beautiful, like, childhood innocence, but at the same time there's some real dark elements to it. When we go into the magical world, we see, like, pelicans who have to prey on these, like, innocent little blob creatures, but only because they themselves are so petrified of starving. But we have, like, great older big sister characters who are kind of, like, helping us along the way, And again, at the very end, we meet this wizard who can sort of create reality however he wants it and tries to bring Mihito into that. And which to me came across as kind of like, again, pulling all the way back into Kiki's Delivery Service about the sort of like usefulness in art and creativity in confronting trauma. So it's really, really good. It's really full. It's got so much going for it that I really think that I have to see it again, because it gets so quite frenetic at the end. There's so many sort of bizarre, it's very like opening the door just takes you into an entirely new world, which I think happens literally multiple times, which again is very Howl's Moving Castle. But it's like we're just jumping about all these different sort of beautiful set pieces and really imaginative scenes. At the heart of it is, you know, Mihito, who is a Ghibli character who, unlike other Ghibli protagonists, from the start we know needs to grow somewhat. Like, he is a conflicted character. He is like a troubled boy. It shows the real like healing possibilities of these magical worlds that you're always showing.
Yeah, and there's other film links as well. Like, after just seeing Graves of the Fireflies, like I say, the opening is very similar, mm-hmm. even though that's not a Miyazaki film. There's a, because it begins with this young kid seeing like firebombs happening to his town and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, so it's like horrific beginning. And you know, the place he moves to is very Totoro like, you know, it's like in the country, there's like kind of magical things happening in the woods, there's a magical tree. I did like this, but I think why I resist it is I've just found it a bit impenetrable. And I think that partly I was maybe too tired or something when I watched it. I have been already berated by Annie Bruce, who is very angry that I only thought this was a middling Miyazaki film. I really want to see it again. But yeah, it's just full of like amazing sort of metaphors and nightmarish imagery. I mean, the heron character is like utterly disgusting. It's like for a kid film. I'm just amazed this has done so well, because like it is one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. This heron who opens up and inside is a man, and with this massive jaw full of teeth, and it comes out teeth first. It's honestly nightmarish. But you know, this is Miyazaki, he does this stuff. He's a masterful filmmaker, hugely imaginative. I'm just really happy he's still making films mm-hmm. Like with like this kind of like imagination at his age. You know, he's like a force of nature.
He will never retire.
He's not
have to drag yeah. him away from the storyboard or the kind of like weird tablet thing with the magic pen.
I can't remember. I'll try and find this quote as quick as I possibly can, but I think that one of the employees at Studio Ghibli was like, I'm no longer trying to get him to retire. Toshio Suzuki, the editor, said that like, I'm no longer trying to get him to retire, it's impossible.
Well, there's also the issue, like, I think the elephant in the room is nobody's really sort of stood in to take his place. Like mm-hmm. like I say, as much as like, you know, when Mani was there, or you know, From Up in Poppy Hill, you know, these are films that are liked, but they're not loved in the same way. They don't seem to have the same magic. So I think that's another issue. Like, there's nobody really been there to take his place. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably why he's stuck around. So it'll be interesting, you know, will there be somebody who can start to take over?
He will not allow it. Hayao Miyazaki will be making films until they drag him away screaming. So that's been Studio Ghibli. If you like flying, coming of age, strong female characters, pigs that drink a lot, the war and the other wars, magic realism, the wonder of nature, the beauty of protecting the environment, big, iconic, fluffy things that look like they'd be very, very nice to hug, amazing English voice cast, hot boys, or Hayao Miyazaki's inability to draw any more than one of the two children's faces that he knows how to draw, then you will find something to love in Studio Ghibli. And one of the great things about doing this episode now, and I know that I was having a go at Netflix earlier, one of the good things they have actually done is all of the, for a long time, the Ghiblis were a mainstay of going to FOP on a Saturday afternoon and being like, I wouldn't pay 25 quid for that, but I would pay 20 if they put the price down in Elge. Now they're all on Netflix. You can really get into the whole back catalogue. And in terms of films to put on a kind of like late winter, early spring evening, when you just want to watch something that will take you to another world, you really can't get a lot better than a Studio Ghibli. Mm-hmm. As long as you pick one of the good ones.
Even the thing is, even the bad ones are great. Like, this this is the weird thing. Like,
we're very much grading on a curve.
Yeah, there's at least 10 masterpieces, at least 10 quite good films, and then a couple of stinkers. You know, that's a pretty good hit rate for any studio.
Yeah, it's a very good hit rate. If you start looking at 1990s Disney, then my God, your chances of winning drastic go down, as the meme says. So I think we've pretty much covered most of Studio Ghibli in the space of an hour and 20 minutes. It's not bad. If you've got an hour and 20 minutes, then by all means, you should have used it to watch a Studio Ghibli film rather than listen to
this. Now you know which one to watch.
Yeah, now you have already listened to it by virtue of how linear time works.
Do we know which the shortest one is? I don't think there's any there. Maybe Totoro.
Again, they have short films. I don't know if their short films are on anything. But
we could get into the short films, but that is maybe a whole other episode.
Just wait until Miyazaki releases another film, and then we're going to have to do this all over again.
Oh, God. And a last-minute shout-out. I don't know whether this is going to be relevant or whether events will have superseded this, but Hayao Miyazaki, when Spirited Away won the Oscar in 2003, didn't come to the US because he said he was against the Iraq War, and he didn't want to go to the US because they were bombing Iraq. Top boy.
Legend.
Big-time ledge. The Porco Rosso of the Studio Ghibli writing and directing staff. So thank you very much, Ellie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie.
Cheers, Pierre.
Go and watch some Studio Ghibli. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. I have had a lovely time, and I'm going to fly back off to... I was going to fly off to somewhere magical, but we actually have to go back to work now, don't we?
Well, there's something magical about work. Just watch Kiki's Delivery Service.
Exactly. See, there's just so many... There's so many, like, drum roll rimshot options that Studio Ghibli presents to us. So, yes, we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.